Hello, and welcome to this episode of our GP Perspectives podcast, featuring peer-to-peer conversations on anything and everything general practice. In this special episode for National Volunteers Week, we are talking about building member communities and how the college can support members in getting your ideas off the ground. I'm Victoria Giorgio Brown, Vice Chair for External Affairs and a practicing GP in Northeast London. And today I'm joined by two special guests, Dr. Arti Bansal and Dr. Mona Aquilina, both of whom are GPs with two different but equally inspiring stories to tell about how they made the college sit up and notice their community and special interest, and of course, what happened next. So, here with me now, I'm very happy to introduce our first guest, Dr. Arti Bansal. Arti is the college's first climate change lead from South Yorkshire, North Trent faculty. Arti, welcome. Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself and how your volunteering journey began?
Hi, Victoria. Yes, thanks for inviting me to the podcast. So I'm a GP in Sheffield, and I currently also am working a day a week for Humber and North Yorkshire ICB as their net zero clinical lead, which is a position I couldn't have imagined even existing a few years ago. And I'm also the director of Greener Practice, which is a community interest company. And the aim of Greener Practice is basically to be the UK's primary care sustainability network to engage general practice towards more environmentally sustainable practice, because we recognise that greener practice is the same as good evidence-based person-centred care. So how did my journey start? Well, it actually started back in 2015. I was sort of peripherally involved with an event that was happening in our city in the lead up to the Paris climate talks. And, you know, many of the listeners might remember that the Paris climate talks was one of those international conference of party talks. And it was the first time that a goal was agreed where, you know, the world's leaders said that we want to make sure that warming doesn't exceed 2 degrees, and with an ambition to limit it to 1.5 degrees. Anyway, sort of in the run up to that, so we were having this event in our city, and I thought I was really quite environmentally aware. I'd been interested in what was happening with the ozone layer and what was happening with the Amazon rainforest back when I was a sixth form student. You know, this was in the early 90s, and I'd kept up with the climate change. I was worried about it. I wanted to do something. But because this was a public facing event, I thought, well, I better just brush up on the science. I better just have a little look at those reports because I'm going to be talking to the public. And when I went back and actually looked at what the situation was, I was really shocked, because despite thinking that I understood the greenhouse gas effect and I understood what was happening, I actually realized I didn't really understand anything about the urgency of the situation. So I kind of naively assumed that because, you know, people had been agreeing and saying that this was important and that we needed to reduce emissions, that progress was being made. I had no idea that despite all the talks, that emissions were actually just going up and up and up. I also didn't realize, because, you know, all of these dates were being bandied about, like 2050 and 2100. And back in 2015, that felt like we had time. And it also felt like this was an issue perhaps that would really affect future generations, like perhaps my grandchildren or my great grandchildren. And then actually looking at the science and realizing that if we continued on our current trajectory, that we were looking at breaching that safe limit of 1.5 degrees of warming, relatively safe limit, I should say, actually, by 2030, that was a real shock to me. I was really sort of taken aback. And then I realized I didn't really understand tipping points either. So this idea that the planet has all of these systems that keep our climate stable, very much like homeostatic systems in our body, and that if we overshot the 1.5 degrees threshold, then there was a risk that all of these tipping points, because they're so interconnected, potentially could get triggered, and then that would lead to potentially severe and irreversible changes in our climate system. So yeah, so I was really shocked and a little bit confused that if this was so important and potentially existential, why weren't we talking about it? You know, why wasn't the world taking action? And, you know, years later, I remember listening to Greta Thunberg saying, "Our house is on fire." And I remember feeling like that at the time. I was thinking, why aren't people sort of saying this is an emergency? This, you know, why aren't we taking emergency action? So I was confused by that, but I was also really frightened. I was frightened for the future now, which I realized was going to be transformatively different, but I couldn't really imagine. I didn't really understand what it was going to look like. And I realized that this was my future, but also my children's future. My children at the time were 7 and 4, and I was really worried for them because, you know, as parents, our first thought is that we want our children to be happy and we want them to have possibilities and potential in their future. And I couldn't really imagine that. And I thought, I really want to do something and I want to try and safeguard their future, but I really didn't know what to do. And what happened was, so how does this all have anything to do with college? What happened was the provost of the South Yorkshire and North Trent faculty, Dr. Amar Rugani, at the time, he had also been on his own sort of personal journey around this and had become increasingly concerned about the climate and ecological crisis. And he knew that I was sort of looking for a speaker for our citywide event. So he knew I was interested in this. In this area. And sort of a few months after that particular event, he invited me for a chat, literally a chat in a pub. And he asked me a question. He said, "What can we do to get our professional community involved in taking action on the climate crisis?" And up until then, I'd only really thought of what I could or couldn't do in terms of a citizen. Being a citizen of my city and the work that was happening with voluntary organizations. And I have to say, I wasn't feeling particularly empowered in that space. So for him to ask me that question and say, "What can we do as a professional community?" That was really exciting because I thought, well, okay, there isn't much happening in this space. And maybe this is a space in which I can feel a little bit more useful than I'm feeling currently as a citizen. So he sort of gave me permission because what he said was, "Let's make you our faculty climate and sustainability lead. And, you know, you go and explore this. How can we engage our professional community?" So that's how it started.
Thank you so much. So do you think you have affected the change or made the impact that you hoped for?
Ah, now that's an interesting question. I think when I started, I really didn't have an idea of what I wanted to happen. I guess I did. I wanted to be as useful to our community. And I think the one of the first things that I realized is that I had to do a lot of learning myself to understand how the climate crisis impacted on health, how all of the things that we want to do in terms of action on the climate crisis were so perfectly aligned with the things that we want to do to improve patient and population health, and also all the different organizations that were working in this space, the different resources that were available. So I'd had to do a lot of learning, and I just thought, We need to make this learning accessible. So that was one thing that I wanted to do. And the other thing that I wanted to do was also to connect, because I knew I wasn't the only one who was interested in this area. I knew there'd be lots and lots of other people having similar thoughts across the country, and that we needed to connect in order to be effective. So I wanted to make sure that we created a network. And then to really influence the institutions, the healthcare institutions, to try and effect change in this area. And I guess if I sort of take those one at a time, so I think I'll have to say yes in terms of yes, I think we have been successful in it, mostly at least in those kind of broad aims. We all, I think, I'm sure Mona's going to agree with me with this one, is that any of us who have an interest in making a change or making a difference probably feel at various points that the change isn't happening as quickly as we'd like it to. And sometimes it's only in retrospect that we can sort of see the change that has happened. So I'm looking several years down the road now from 2017, and I can see a lot has changed. You know, there's many things that I would have liked to still be happening that perhaps aren't happening, and things that maybe could have been done quicker. But in those broad areas, I think we have made the change. So, for example, that need to, you know, create a space for people to quickly be able to access what they need to know in terms of primary care and environmental sustainability. Basically, that conversation with Amar early on, that sort of led within a few months to the creation of the Greener Practice Network. So it started off with just getting a few people we knew in Sheffield who were either interested in the topic or had been interested or involved in creating movements in other ways. So I remember one of the first people we invited to have a chat in the evening was a doctor called Ollie Hart, and he's done a lot of work in Sheffield around an initiative called Move More, which is around physical activity and promoting physical activity in the city. So we felt his learning would be really useful. We involved somebody who was interested in the CCG. I was very involved in medical education at the time, so we got a medical student involved because we wanted their perspective. So it started off quite small, you know, just a few people around a kitchen table. But over time, it has now become a network with local groups, literally from the Highlands of Scotland to Cornwall. We've got presence in Wales and Northern Ireland. I think we've got over 30 groups across the country. But what we've also been able to do is now I'm no longer the South Yorkshire North Trent Faculty Climate and Sustainability Lead. I've now passed that baton on to others. And so there are other people doing that, but there are now faculty and climate and sustainability champions in nearly every single faculty of the college. So that in itself is now a college network. So the college has its own network of leads who meet together and who share their learning and share how they can inspire work in their local area. So I feel like we did the information sharing, we did the network building. In terms of sort of influencing organizations, one of the first things that came out of that question, and initially talking to people about what could we do, was at our faculty level, we put a motion in to College Council around the climate emergency. And in that motion basically stated that the college recognised the climate emergency, it recognised its impact on health, and its duty to act on the climate emergency. And we were able to get that motion sort of co-sponsored by the North East London faculty. It was presented to the College Council, and it was unanimously passed, pretty much, you know. So that then set off a trajectory within Central College. So we were asked to create a short working life group to look at, okay, what can the college do and what should it be doing in the first year and in the long term? That led to top 10 actions that the college could take in the first year. Not all of those actions happened, but some really key ones did. So I've already talked about creating a network of faculty champions, but we also had something about the college curriculum, including planetary health and linking it into all of the other things that are influenced by planetary health. So health inequalities and long-term condition work and personalized healthcare. So sort of seeing it as principles. And that work happened. It now is part of the college curriculum. So those are quite some quite significant changes. The other thing that now happens is that any paper that comes to college has to have had an assessment around environmental sustainability. There's a form that people can look at to help them understand what they should be thinking of. And It's definitely there. It's starting to get used. So that those are quite significant changes that have been made, really as a result of somebody asking a question about what can we do. So I do feel like we have definitely made a huge amount of progress. A lot more to do, but we have made progress.
Absolutely, and what amazing work. So, what would you say to anyone thinking about reaching out and getting involved?
So what I would say to somebody who's wanting to reach out and learn more about sustainable healthcare is a good place to start is the RCGP's Net Zero Hub. It has three really fantastic e-learning modules, only half an hour long. The first one's like an introduction, the second one is specific on asthma, and the third one is around carbon footprinting. So that's a really good place to start. It's also got some other resources in there. And then there's another website, the Greener Practice website, which is like a one-stop hub for all things primary care sustainability, where you can also do learning. You can connect to the other organizations that are involved in this space, but you can also find out where the local groups are that are doing work on this activity, so you can connect with other people. And then, of course, if you're wanting to get active with the RCGP, then your faculty should probably have a faculty climate and sustainability lead. So, find out who that is, reach out, find out what you can help and support them with. And you could yourself think about becoming one of those leads, or even joining the National Council and learning more about how to influence the college at that sort of national stage. So lots and lots of ways really to reach out and connect and get involved.
Thank you so much, Artie. It's great to hear about all you're doing and how your journey has evolved over time. So, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work Artie is involved in, or if you would like to get involved in sustainability campaigns, you can find links and resources in the description below. Sustainability is, of course, one of the college's priorities now, so there will be lots of opportunities to work together on this important area going forward. So, our second guest today was the driving force behind our later career and retired member committee. So, welcome, Mona. Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey in starting up the LCARM, as it is called, so later career and retired member committee?
Thank you for inviting me to this podcast. And yes, my journey. I was actually born and brought up in Malta, and I spent the first 20 years of my life there. But I came to UK to do my clinical learning. And within a year of qualifying, I was very clear I wanted to become a GP, actually. So way back in 1985, I passed my membership, which wasn't compulsory at the time, and I settled into being a partner in an inner city London practice full time for 30 years. I was also a GP trainer, and I mean, honestly, where have the last 30 years gone? Time flew. But from very early on, as a young GP, we had talks about retirement. But all the talk was around superannuation and financial planning, etc. I like to think of myself as quite an organized person. So I thought, yes, I'll retire in, the normal retirement age for people from my cohort was 60 years. And I thought, yes, I'll retire at 60. And I went on the BMA pre-retirement course when I was 58 years old. So I thought I was highly organized. And when I taught, after 30 years of being in the same practice, I thought, actually, I don't want to stop working clinically, but I don't want to stay as a partner anymore. I want more flexibility. My practice was in a very good place, so I felt I was leaving it in good hands, passing on the baton to an excellent group of partners and trainers. So I thought, yes, I'll freelance as a sessional GP and do some educational work. What I wasn't prepared for when I left the partnership was actually how very quickly isolated one is. And I think a lot of locum sessional GPs may well share this, but it was certainly not anything I was expecting. Also, you take so many links for granted when you're in a practice or in an area with established links, including your educator links. So although I was doing sessional work, I was slightly at sea, and I couldn't find any educator work either, because I wasn't fixed to one practice, so I couldn't sort of teach trainees or teach undergraduates. And because I had more time, believe it or not, I attended my very first RCGP annual conference. And I went to the membership desk and I asked them, what's the college doing for people like me, who is sort of not fully retired, but making the transition to full retirement? And the person there said, nothing, actually. We have got a retired doctors group, but they're not very active. And by the way, I later discovered that they weren't really retired. They were still working GPs, but had taken 24-hour retirement and were still working at least six sessions a week. She said, but anyway, she made a note of my name and address. And I was really impressed that a few months later, she came back to me and said, we're setting up a working group, a retired doctor's working group, to see what the college can offer senior doctors. Would you like to join this working group? Which I thought, I felt really flattered by that, because I'd been too busy to be involved in any college-y stuff other than the educator role I was involved with. So I said yes. So I joined the retired doctor's working group, which held a series of meetings over 2 years. And at the end of the 2 years, it was recognized that there was an unmet need for senior doctors to help support them to their transition to retirement. And it was decided to set up what was called a Later Career and Retired Members Committee. Just as an aside, it took us a full meeting to discuss, to agree on a name, because LCARM is easy, strips off the tongue now, but Later Career and Retired Members Committee is a bit clumsy. But we thought at the end that Later Career reflected any doctor who self-identified as being in the later phases of their career. We didn't want to fix a date, because some people would define themselves later for career as 50 plus, whereas others would define themselves as later career as 60 plus. I worked with a doctor who was 80 plus when he retired from our practice, So self-identify as later career. But some people in the working group felt very strongly that the word retired should be included in the title, because they felt that you need to sort of acknowledge the fact that eventually one does retire clinically, and that the college should also embrace its retired clinical members. So that's how the Later Career and Retired Members Committee was set up in 2019, so not that long ago. And I was invited to be its first chair. I was also at a very conference, I also decided to become a member of my local faculty in South London. So I'd already built links. As Artie said earlier, it's important to build links within your own faculty. So I'd already built links there. And within 3 months of LCARM being launched, we had Later Career and Retired Members faculty leads across most of UK. So that was the start of our group.
Amazing. So how has bringing your ideas and interests to the college impacted you as a GP and member, but also you think probably has impacted others through your work?
Sure. One very important point is the connections that you build through having a group like the ELCOM group. So although there was nothing happening in South London faculty, for example, to prepare doctors for retirement, in other faculties, they were running transition courses, for example. So one very important point is sharing good practice. And people in London think, oh, Vale of Trent is doing transition courses, why don't we run them in South London? So that was really, really key. The other important factor was visibility. So a lot of GPs thought and still think that a lot of senior doctors haven't got any needs, but actually there's a lot of unmet need out there, because people think, a lot of people told me when I was saying I was retiring from my practice, oh, lucky you, you know, going off into the sunset. But actually quite a lot of doctors, it's not as simple as that. It's not all or nothing. A lot of senior doctors may not want to do the full, you know, volume of clinical work that they did when they were 30 or 40 or 50. They might want to do less or develop other interests, diversify their roles. I mean, younger doctors have started off in a much better place because, you know, diverse portfolio careers is part of life now. But certainly when I was a younger doctor, it was almost frowned upon to diversify, actually, unless you were an educator or on the LMC or something. So, you know, a lot of senior doctors need an encouragement to sort of diversify their roles. So part of what we were a point of contact for a lot of doctors to say, look, you know, please help me. In my first year and a half, I was approached by a lot of doctors who just wanted a chat, who just wanted support about the career direction. So we were a very good point of contact. And also to flag up what was needed for senior doctors within the college itself. So a lot of retired doctors felt that once they'd retired clinically, the college, the NHS, didn't want to know them anymore. And, you know, obviously there are a lot of brilliant retired GPs out there doing, you know, brilliant things, charity work, volunteer work, etc. But actually, why doesn't the NHS, why doesn't the college use this wisdom and expertise? So some of it was highlighting the fact that retired doctors, doctors who are clinically retired, need to be utilized and used within the system. And then, of course, COVID came along when thousands of retired GPs and doctors volunteered to help out in the pandemic, including clinically. I did too, actually. By then I'd stopped my sessional work, but I volunteered to return to work with the COVID Clinical Assessment 111 service. So the COVID happened March 2020, before, you know, the government realized how serious it was. Actually, it was Amar Rugani also, who Artie mentioned earlier, approached the lead in Yorkshire and said, what are ELCOM going to do to sort of try and influence policy? And we had email links. Obviously, the group communicated by email then. We have a WhatsApp group now. But, you know, I remember I wrote a letter to the college RCGP officers in early March to say, here we are, willing and ready to help. But these are the things that are needed to help, you know, retired doctors return to work to help out in the pandemic. And I must say, the college was really approachable. I had a direct link with Amanda Howe, who was the college president at the time. So we could feed our ideas in. And there were a lot of problems with onboarding, you know, the sort of nuts and bolts of trying to prove you were eligible to work in the NHS. We had to go through all that. Even though we'd all worked in the NHS for 30 plus years, but you had to start all over again. So we could feed any problems directly to the college officers who then had links, you know, with NHS England and NHS in other, you know, in the other nations. So, you know, having an established community within the college was really useful within the pandemic. I also switched to Zoom, and, you know, the national committee, we were able to meet really regularly. We met at least every couple of months to discuss issues that arose from the pandemic, problems, solutions, etc. So that was great. And the other big thing we've managed to achieve is sort of organizing local and national events. So local events were very important during the pandemic, for example, but also we highlight what happens beyond the clinical coalface. So linking in with what Artie said earlier, there's a series, online series, Beyond the Clinical Coalface. So we've had people who have retired GPs who are now educators, publishers, writers. We had the doctor from Extinction Rebellion, who a retired GP, who, when he was asked, why did you join Extinction Rebellion? He said, well, when I was a GP, I could recognize an emergency in the waiting room. I had to drop everything and, you know, deal with the emergency. So now I recognize that climate issue is an emergency, and this is what I do now. I'm an activist. You know, there is a landing page. We organized a content for a landing page on the RCGP website with vignettes, because people love stories. So they love, you know, reading stories and hearing stories. What did you do when you grow up, Mum? You know, so what did you do when you retired? What happened after that? And stories inspire people. Yes, our motto is lifelong learning, lifelong connections. And I think lifelong genuinely means lifelong. I think a lot of things doctors share is a love of learning, actually. So I think lifelong means beyond retirement from clinical practice. So that is how it's helped the sort of the group. At a personal level, I've made some wonderful friends, made wonderful links. It certainly helped me, because although initially I thought what we needed ELCOM form was to help with the transition into retirement. Actually, there are two other big issues we've been involved with. One is retention, which obviously doesn't involve just later career doctors. It's sort of doctors, you know, from when they qualify. But a lot of our work has been about retention. So we've done a lot of work, including, you know, we've had representation on the revalidation working group to encourage senior doctors to view appraisal as an opportunity, not a barrier. So that, because it's the only time an appraisal really is doctors can talk about themselves. So for the appraisal process to be useful to the appraisee. So, and also not for the appraiser, not to sort of just a doctor's going to retire, to so just explore a little bit more the issues around that and talk about plans, perhaps point them in the direction of ELCOM. And another big area we've worked on as a group is using the expertise of clinically retired GPs in education, mentoring especially. And we've also been involved with the RCGP mentoring platform. So a lot of retired GPs who are who are qualified mentors, indeed qualified coaches. And just being involved with all this work actually has helped me enormously. I started off as practically just left my partnership, became a sessional doctor, became an emergency registered practitioner. I think I'm ready now to properly retire from my clinical work. But now I know that it doesn't mean I have to, you know, lose all my links with the GP community.
Yes. And you mentioned that you joined your local faculty when you were approaching retirement. How did you find that? And would you advise other people with brilliant ideas, you know, who want to suggest them to the college to approach their faculties first, perhaps?
Yes, I do. I do. I think people are a bit sort of, I think, frightened of the local faculty, frightened of the commitment. I think the fact that a lot of faculty meetings are now online, or there's a mixture, actually helps, because GPs are very, very busy people. And, you know, I think a lot of people are worried about the time commitment. So I think, you know, joining your local faculties means you are meeting a lot of GPs in your area and building links. So, and also each faculty has got a faculty representative, and that can influence council, you know, by bringing, you know, motions to council. So yes, I would definitely recommend that people who are interested make links with their local faculty. Yeah. And also, you know, go along to faculty events, even if they decide not to join the faculty board. All faculties organize summer outings and spring outings. So, you know, it's nice to sort of get to meet people and maybe have an informal chat first about what it's like to be a board member.
I agree, and I definitely found the same with my faculty. Thank you so much, Mona. It's great to hear your story and how the committee is shaping up today, and also the difference that it is making. It's clear that you're very passionate about ensuring that the ELCAM community is represented, and I'm sure it will continue doing a great work going forward. And that brings us to the end of our podcast. A huge thank you to our guests for sharing their stories with us and taking the time to chat with me today. If you would like to learn more about the topics we have discussed, check out the description box for links and resources. And who knows, today could be the start of your own journey. And if you are enjoying these conversations, then please do share them with a friend or tag us in your next social media post using @TeamGP. Thanks for listening, and take care.